Imagine you're asleep, right? And it's like 2 a.m. And this completely silent piece of code just travels through your Wi-Fi, and it completely erases the brain of your front door lock.
Oh, yeah.
Just wipes it, rewrites it from scratch, and then reboots it. And if it makes even like a single mathematical error during that whole process, you're locked out of your house forever.
Yep, you'd be totally stuck.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are pulling back the curtain on the invisible software that makes that late-night digital magic actually possible. We're looking at the unseen architecture running, well, almost every electronic device in our modern world.
Yeah, it really is this vast hidden ecosystem, and to navigate it today, we're using a really comprehensive technical guide. It was published by Embedded Hash,
Right.
and they've provided this incredibly detailed breakdown of the critical differences and the delicate and sometimes perilous relationship between two very specific components in embedded systems, and those are the bootloaders and the firmware.
Okay, let's unpack this because terms like bootloader and firmware, I mean, they sound like deep tech jargon,
Oh,
right? They
absolutely.
sound like concepts that are just relegated to some computer engineer sitting in a clean room somewhere. But these two pieces of software are really the unsung heroes of our daily lives. I mean, they are inside the coffee maker you used this morning. They're in the smart thermostat on your wall, the anti-lock braking sensors in your car.
Yeah, they are entirely inescapable. I mean, whenever you press a physical button and a machine responds in the real world, you are interacting with firmware.
Okay.
But the only reason that firmware is running safely, and really the only reason it can ever be improved or fixed, is because of the bootloader.
Right.
You really just cannot grasp how modern electronics function or how they fail without understanding how this specific duo operates.
So let's establish the dynamic between these two, because as I was reading the guide, I've been visualizing them as sort of the worker and the
I
manager.
like that.
So let's look at the worker first. In the context of a smart device, what fundamentally constitutes the firmware?
Well, firmware is software, obviously, but it is a software that's physically bound to a specific piece of hardware.
Okay.
So it resides in non-volatile memory, which is usually flash memory.
And non-volatile just means.
It just means the data persists even without power.
Yeah.
So if you unplug the device, the memory doesn't wipe. It just waits for the next surge of electricity. So the firmware is this highly specialized code that tells the microcontroller, which is the tiny brain of the device, how to execute its primary purpose.
So if we assume our listeners know what a smart thermostat does, it reads the room temperature, triggers the HVAC system, updates the little screen. The
Exactly.
firmware is the specific localized code running those exact physical hardware components.
Yeah, to put a finer point on it, the firmware's entire universe is that specific physical hardware. It handles the raw inputs. So, reading the voltage from a temperature sensor, intercepting your button presses, and then it translates those into physical outputs, like spinning up a motor or illuminating an LED panel.
Oh, I see.
And sometimes it juggles these tasks using an ArcQOS, a real-time operating system, which just ensures critical tasks happen at exact microsecond intervals. But its focus is entirely on the application itself.
So using an analogy here, the firmware is kind of like a highly skilled executive chef in a restaurant.
Okay, yeah.
The chef knows precisely how to sear the steak, how to chop the vegetables, plate the food perfectly. The food is the product, so the chef is obviously essential.
Right.
But if the chef is entirely focused on the cutting board, who opens the front doors of the restaurant at 5 a.m., who verifies the kitchen meets health codes, and crucially, if the chef needs to be replaced because the menu changes or something, who does the firing and hiring?
What's fascinating here is that you've just perfectly isolated the exact vulnerability of firmware.
Oh, really?
Yeah, firmware cannot manage itself.
Oh.
It cannot update itself safely without risking total corruption. So the entity that unlocks the doors, checks the safety protocols, and basically manages the chef is the bootloader.
The manager.
The manager, yeah, the bootloader is this highly specialized, completely isolated program that runs before the main firmware ever even wakes up.
Okay.
Its whole mandate is to prepare the system, cryptographically verify that the firmware is actually safe and intact, facilitate updates if it needs to, and then finally relinquish control to the firmware.
Okay, take me into that exact millisecond a device gets plugged in.
Sure.
Because the device is completely dark, you plug it into the wall, power floods the circuit board. What is the very first spark of life?
Yeah.
Because the source guide breaks down all the bootloader's responsibilities, but I want to understand the actual chronological sequence.
So the absolute first spark of life, which is triggered by the hardware resetting or powering on, is the processor looking at a hard-coded memory address and executing the bootloader.
Okay, so the bootloader is first.
Always first. The bootloader basically wakes up in an empty house, and immediately it conducts a situational assessment.
Like looking around.
Exactly. It checks the hardware state, looks for user inputs, like if someone is holding down a physical reset button or something.
Oh, right, right.
And crucially, it checks external communication interfaces to see if a new firmware update is just, you know, waiting in the wings.
Okay, let's assume there is no update waiting.
Mm.
It's just a normal Tuesday morning.
Right. In that scenario, the bootloader turns its attention to the flash memory where the main firmware lives, but it doesn't just blindly start the code.
It checks it first.
Yeah. A secure bootloader performs an integrity check. So it calculates this mathematical hash of the firmware in the memory and compares it against an expected value.
Okay.
And if that math matches, it confirms the firmware is intact, it hasn't degraded or gotten corrupted, and it is safe to run.
And then?
Only then does it hand over the keys to the chef.
Okay, but let's rewind and look at the alternative, because this is where the real magic happens, I think. What if the bootloader wakes up, looks around, and sees that my smartphone has sent an over-the-air, or OTA, update via Wi-Fi overnight?
Okay, yep.
So the bootloader intercepts this new code. If I'm understanding this correctly from the guide, it then basically erases the device's current brain and writes a new one.
What?
Hey, hold on. If it's erasing the brain, where's the bootloader itself sitting? I mean, how does a brain erase itself without dying in the process?
Right, so let's clarify the architecture there, because the bootloader isn't erasing itself.
Oh, okay.
It is erasing a segregated partition of the memory. So think of OTA updates less like open heart surgery and more like rebuilding an airplane's engine while it's still in the air.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, the bootloader is the co-pilot. When an update arrives, the co-pilot takes complete control of the plane, isolates the main pilot, swaps him out for a new one, and then hands the controls back.
But wait, if the power goes out while the co-pilot is swapping the pilots, the plane crashes, right? Yeah.
Naturally.
Like if my Wi-Fi drops or the power cuts halfway through writing the new firmware, my device just has half a brain now.
And that is the historic danger of embedded updates, which is exactly why modern systems use an ingenious mechanism, and it's called AB Dual Bank Flash.
AB Dual Bank. Okay, tell me about AB banking.
So instead of one massive application region for the memory is split into two identical banks, Bank A and Bank B.
Okay.
Let's say your current perfectly working firmware is running in Bank A.
Right.
The bootloader receives the new update in the background and carefully writes it into Bank B. Bank A is completely untouched during this.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And once the entire download is finished, it's verified and perfectly written into Bank B, the bootloader just flips a digital switch.
So the next time the device reboots, it just points to Bank B instead of Bank A.
Precisely. Oh, oh. And if the power cuts out while it's writing to Bank B, it doesn't matter. The bootloader wakes up, sees that Bank B is corrupted or incomplete, just throws it out, and simply boots the perfectly intact Bank A.
So your device never breaks?
Never breaks. It seamlessly falls back to the old version.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, it removes the anxiety from updates entirely.
It really does.
But because the bootloader and the firmware and potentially Bank A and Bank B are all living inside one tiny microscopic silicon chip, it begs a physical question for me.
Okay.
How do they not step on each other's toes?
Well, they require strict, uncompromising digital boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, flash memory is not just a free-for-all bucket of data. It is meticulously partitioned.
Right. Here's where it gets really interesting, because we are essentially talking about digital real estate.
Yes.
If flash memory is a big, empty plot of land, who decides where the property lines are actually drawn?
Right.
Because if the bootloader lives on the north side and the firmware lives on the south side, they need some kind of map to ensure they don't accidentally build a strip mall over each other's homes.
Yeah, and that architectural blueprint is known as the linker script.
Linker script.
Yeah. When a developer is writing the software for an embedded device, they don't just compile the code into ones and zeros and throw it in. They must explicitly instruct the compiler exactly where in the physical silicon memory that code is allowed to reside.
Oh, wow.
So the bootloader gets one strict address range, and the application gets a totally separate one.
So what happens if a developer messes up this blueprint? Like, what if the linker script is just wrong? Does the bootloader accidentally pave a parking lot over its own bedroom?
Yeah, pretty much. And the consequences of a misconfigured linker script are immediate and terminal.
Oh, man.
If the memory boundaries overlap, the bootloader might literally overwrite its own instructions while trying to save an update.
That's bad.
It's very bad. But more commonly, the application simply won't start. The processor will jump to the address where it expects the application to begin, it finds garbage data, and it throws what we call a hard fault.
A hard fault.
A hard fault. It is a fatal error state. The microcontroller essentially throws its hands up, stops all execution, and just freezes.
Yike.
Yeah. And the source guide emphasizes that for popular platforms like the STM32 family of microcontrollers, mastering this memory map is non-negotiable.
Right.
And it's not just the application code either. You have to perfectly place the interrupt vector table.
Okay, interrupt vector table. That sounds intense. Let's demystify that for the listener.
It's actually not too bad. Think of the interrupt vector table as the microcontroller's emergency speed dial list.
Speed dial list.
Yeah, yeah. When a physical event happens in the real world, say you press a button on your thermostat, a voltage spikes. The processor has to instantly drop whatever it's calculating in that moment and look up what that voltage means.
Right.
So it consults the vector table to find the exact memory address of the code that handles button presses.
Oh, I get it. So if the linker script is wrong and the bootloader and firmware have their wires crossed, the processor hits speed dial for the button press and accidentally calls the codes that, like, turns on the furnace to maximum heat instead.
Yeah, exactly. Or it just calls empty space and crashes entirely. And the thing is, the bootloader has its own speed dial list, and the application has a completely separate one.
Oh, wow.
So when the bootloader hands control over to the application, it actually has to relocate the processor's attention from one vector table to the other. It has an incredibly delicate digital baton pass.
Okay, so the blueprint stops them from overwriting each other internally.
Right.
But what if the threat doesn't come from inside the house? Like, we talked about power outages and AB banking, but what about malicious intent?
Oh,
because if the bootloader's job is to accept new code over Wi-Fi and install it, what stops a hacker from just sending fake firmware to my lock to spy on my network?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is really where the bootloader transcends being a simple memory manager and becomes the ultimate cryptographic gatekeeper.
Okay.
We are stepping into the realm of the secure bootloader.
The secure bootloader.
Yes. A secure bootloader must answer two completely different questions before it allows any code to execute. The first is integrity, which we kind of discussed earlier. Is the file corrupted?
Right, like the math checks out, there are no missing pieces.
Exactly. But the second question is authenticity.
Authenticity.
Right. Did this perfectly intact file actually come from a trusted source? And to guarantee this, manufacturers use public key cryptography.
I want to dig into the how of this. Like, how does math actually prove ownership or authenticity?
So let's use a physical analogy. Imagine the manufacturer has a private cryptographic key, which functions kind of like a unique wax seal stamp.
Okay, a wax seal.
Right. And this stamp is locked in a vault at their headquarters. It never leaves.
Got it.
When they finish writing a new firmware update, they stamp it with that private key, generating a digital signature.
Okay, so the file arrives at my smart lock bearing this official wax seal.
Right. Now, your device bootloader holds the public key. But the public key is not a stamp. It is simply a photograph of what the true wax seal is supposed to look like.
Oh, I see.
The bootloader cannot create the seal itself, but it can look at the code it just downloaded, look at the photograph, and perform a mathematical comparison.
Right.
If they match flawlessly, the bootloader knows with absolute certainty that only the entity holding the stamp in the vault could have created this file.
And if a hacker writes their own, you know, brilliant piece of malware, perfectly coded, and sends it to my lock,
the hacker doesn't have the stamp.
Right.
I mean, they can forge a seal, but when the bootloader checks it against the public key photograph, the math will fail. The bootloader will immediately reject the code, erase it from the memory bank, and refuse to install it. It basically says, this code is intact, but it did not come from my boss, so it does not run.
That is incredibly robust.
It is.
You know, it makes me wonder, if the bootloader's doing all this heavy lifting, I mean, allocating memory, checking cryptographic wax seals, routing speed dial vector tables, managing network downloads, is it basically just a tiny operating system? Like, is my coffee maker actually running a microscopic version of Windows or Linux?
It has a really natural comparison to make, but it's actually a fundamental misunderstanding of the architecture.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a bootloader and firmware do not equal an operating system.
Okay.
An OS, like Linux, is a massive, heavy piece of software designed for dynamic overhead. You know, it manages hundreds of background services, dynamic RAM allocation, it schedules multiple applications running simultaneously.
Like my laptop running a browser, a video call, and downloading a file, all at the exact same instant.
Correct. A simple microcontroller running a smart sensor just doesn't need that massive overhead. It usually runs its firmware directly on the bare metal hardware.
Bare metal.
Right, there is no OS in the way. The bootloader wakes up, does its rigorous security checks, points the processor to the firmware, and then completely exits the stage.
Oh, it just leaves.
It leaves.
Yeah.
The firmware then loops its specific tasks indefinitely, tied directly to the silicon. And even in devices that do use embedded Linux, the bootloader's only job is to load the Linux kernel into memory and start it. After that, the bootloader just goes to sleep.
Listening to this cascading complexity, I mean, the hardware memory mapping, the cryptography, the vector tables, the bare metal execution, It really highlights the learning curve for anyone trying to enter this field.
Oh, for sure.
If I'm an engineering student, I can just decide to study bootloaders on a random Tuesday?
You absolutely cannot. The source guide explicitly lays out a sequential learning path because bootloader development is really the culmination of multiple disciplines.
Right.
Step one is mastering C programming because that gives you efficient, low-level control over data. But step two is embedded C.
What's the distinction there between C and embedded C?
Embedded C forces you to understand how code interacts with the actual physical world.
Oh.
So you have to learn about pointers, which directly manipulate physical memory addresses, and you have to learn about volatile variables.
Volatile variables? What does that mean?
A volatile variable basically tells the compiler, hey, this specific piece of data might be changed at any millisecond by a physical sensor in the real world without the software predicting it. So do not optimize it or assume it stays constant.
Wow. It's like software bowing to physics.
It really is. And from there, step three is understanding the microcontroller hardware itself. Mm-hmm. You know, the CPU architecture, the RAM, the communication protocols like SPI or UART that shuffle data around the board.
Right.
And then step four is writing basic application firmware, just making an LED blink, reading a sensor.
And only then at step five do you finally touch the bootloader.
Exactly, because writing a bootloader means you are writing code that manipulates, evaluates, and controls other code. You cannot manage the chef if you don't intimately understand how the kitchen works.
So what does this all mean for us? Let's take these highly abstract concepts and map them onto the physical objects our listeners actually interact with daily. The guide points to automotive embedded systems, which I think is probably the ultimate proving ground for this technology, right? Because Modern cars are no longer just mechanical machines. They are rolling computer networks.
They absolutely are. A modern vehicle contains dozens of independent computers. They're called electronic control units, or ECUs.
Okay, ECUs.
Yeah, you have an ECU dedicated entirely to engine timing. You have another one for the anti-lock braking system, another for the airbag deployment, and one for the dashboard infotainment.
Wow.
And these ECUs communicate constantly over robust vehicle networks, commonly using CAN, which is controller area network protocols.
So imagine a scenario where a software bug is discovered in the anti-lock braking logic.
Okay.
In the past, that meant a massive physical recall. You'd receive a letter in the mail, you'd drive to a dealership, you sit in a waiting room drinking stale coffee, while a mechanic physically plugs a diagnostic tool under your steering wheel just to flash the memory.
Oh, yeah. It was a nightmare. But today, because of OTA secure bootloaders, that paradigm is dead. The manufacturer just pushes a patch over the cellular network to your car while it sits in your driveway at night.
But the stakes are incredibly high here.
Uh-huh.
We aren't talking about a coffee maker anymore. We are talking about a 2-ton vehicle moving at 70 miles per hour.
Which is exactly why the bootloader architecture is so incredibly vital.
Right.
The central gateway bootloader receives the patch. It verifies the cryptographic wax seal to ensure hackers aren't trying to, you know, disable your brakes. It manages the CAN network traffic and safely writes the update to the specific braking ECU using that AB dual bank method we discussed.
Oh, wow.
And if anything goes wrong during that process, it just falls back to the safe version. So by the time you start your car in the morning, the brakes are completely secured and updated.
It saves manufacturers billions in recall logistics, and it obviously saves consumers massive headaches. And it's all orchestrated by this totally invisible manager.
Yeah, it really is.
So just to summarize our deep dive today, the firmware is the specialized worker. It runs the motors, it reads the sensors, displays the temperature. But the bootloader is the silent guardian.
Mm-hmm.
It wakes up first, enforces the digital borders, verifies the cryptography, handles the perilous task of updating the system, and then just quietly steps aside.
Yeah, together, they really form the bedrock architecture of the connected era. Uh-huh. However, analyzing this architecture, specifically the cryptographic security we covered, it presents a really fascinating puzzle for the listener to consider.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we detailed how secure bootloaders use that digital wax seal to ensure new firmware can only come from the trusted manufacturer holding the private key.
Right, which keeps malicious actors from installing spyware on my thermostat or, you know, hijacking my car's braking system, which is objectively a good thing.
It is an essential safety mechanism, but it also creates this ethical paradox regarding hardware ownership.
Okay, how so?
Well, if the bootloader lock inside the silicon has the ultimate physical power to reject any unauthorized firmware, and only the manufacturer holds the cryptographic key in their vault to authorize it, who actually owns that physical device sitting on your kitchen counter?
Oh, I see. If I buy a piece of hardware with my own money, and I want to write my own custom code to make it do something new, the bootloader will block me, because I don't have the wax seal.
Exactly. You own the plastic and the silicon, but the manufacturer maintains absolute authority over what that hardware is permitted to think and execute.
Man, that is a brilliant puzzle to leave on, the tension between consumer safety and ultimate ownership.
Yeah, it's a lot to think about.
It really is. Well, thank you to the listener for joining us on this deep dive from the mechanics of dual bank flash memory to the invisible architecture running our lives. Next time you look at your smart lock or start your car, remember the tiny manager waking up first to keep the whole operation secure. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.